We sang two songs this morning that fit with my thoughts today. Now, you might not see it here after a bit, but like Jesus said, I hope you will know hereafter. You will see it hereafter. We sang, I love thy kingdom, Lord. And we talked about, we exalted the Lord's kingdom. And we also talked about love for Christ. And when I think about love for Christ, I think about our commitment to him and to his kingdom. And I want to thank you in advance for being a gracious audience and congregation, because I'm stepping onto, perhaps a different type of message than what we're used to having. So let's roll back the benches and think about this as school desks, and we're going to have a time of teaching, and I'm sorry to say we're not going to have a lot of scriptural inspiration because, well, I had several requests come from you all as a congregation to have a message about social security. And as I jumped into it, I don't know how we can talk about social security without going into the history of it and what the program is. And so this is going to feel more like maybe a Wednesday evening topic more so than a Sunday morning message. I'm going to read also, let me say it this way. Because of its origin and the length of time since the program was started, there's probably many people that don't know, probably some of you here don't realize what Social Security actually is or what it was intended to be. And maybe you're ignorant. So this topic is to inform the ignorant, and I'm not calling you ignorant because as we go about, you may think that I'm ignorant on this topic myself. And I know it is also not related to the same by everyone that is here today. There are different views, and so I feel very uneasy about that on the one hand. But it's my goal to try and relate the history and current facts in this segment, meaning we plan to have part two. This is part one. I don't know when part two will be, if it will be this coming Sunday or if it will be in two Sundays later. I want to speak clearly. I do not intend to condemn anyone, but I want to share what I believe I've been asked to share and also where my heart is. This is not an abnormal thing to talk about a topic that is not viewed the same by all the listeners. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 7 says, howbeit, there is not in every man that knowledge, for some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. And I know we're not talking about meats offered to idols, but there was the audience, the churches did not all see the topic the same. So it is with Social Security exemption. I do want to read a few scriptures about the government because I'm not sure what else we're going to talk about. I plan to ask some questions at the end that I want to consider and answer the next time I need to preach. So you may turn with me to Romans chapter 13, and this is the only scripture I'm planning to turn to. I don't even have a lot of comment about this. For a title is Social Security Exemption, Option, Privilege, or Devoir. And I did not go looking for a word that, okay, assuming that at least half of you are the same as me, you have not used the word devoir in the last week, maybe have not ever heard of it, as I didn't until last evening. I was looking for a word, and the thesaurus helped me with this. So I was not looking for, as one preacher said years ago, about a 13-cylinder word. I wasn't looking for one of those. Devoir simply is this. It's duty or responsibility as a formal act of respect is another definition for it. So Social Security exemption, option, question mark, privilege, question mark, or devoir, which is something that we do because it's a respect. And what I mean by that is it's a duty or responsibility because someone is identifying with the kingdom of heaven. Part one, to be continued. So first, Romans 13, we're going to read verses 1 to 7. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but for conscience sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And we'll stop there. We could keep reading. But I think what the writer to the Romans is trying to tell us is that the powers that are set up in the state, as we look at it, as we call it today, are there because God has placed them there. And at times, God's people suffer because of that, and at times we do not. We are find ourselves, a lot of all the generations represented here is the minister of God to thee for good. We have not suffered at the hand of the state as some of our forefathers have. But we are called here to honor, and we're to pay, and we're to follow the ordinances. Obviously, Peter also used those words, I believe it was Peter, when he said, we ought to obey God rather than men. And so there is times where we do not follow and obey the government because it is taking us away from honoring God. So I want to start, first of all, with, and again, I don't know if I said this already, but I'm especially sorry to you folks that are visitors because the, as it were, the meat of this topic, scriptural part of it, will not be till the next time when we're going to look at it in depth and try and help us evaluate with God's word this subject. So the information that I have for you here today comes from three different sources, and there's many more than three sources. The one is a book entitled The Amish and the State. It's a book of, I don't know how many chapters it is. I read mainly one chapter, which is talking about Social Security. I don't even remember who wrote that chapter. It's a book that's authored by several different people, but it's The Amish and the State. And then also got a lot of information right off the Social Security Administration's website. It's packed full of history. And so you will find much of what we're talking about right on the Social Security Administration website. And also, I listened to two topics by Brother Harold Kurtz, and some of you here might know who Harold Kurtz is, an Eastern man from Lancaster County. I had topics at a seminar some months ago. So part of what brought this to the forefront is when we talked about getting exemption for our congregation with the new conference starting, and also we talked about Form 4029, and Brother Jason asked me to preach on it, as well as I know there's at least one other person here that asked questions about it, and I don't intend to make more questions, but if it does, I'm willing to talk to you about it. So the Social Security Act was signed into law by President Roosevelt in 1935. In addition to several other provisions that were for general welfare, the new act created a social insurance program designed to pay retired workers age 65 and older a continuing income after retirement. And that comes right off the Social Security's website. So this is an insurance program is what it's called. And I think back in the early days, it was actually called social insurance at times. So America was going through a number of changes right around this time, at the turn of the century, of the 1900s. A number of changes going on, especially from the years 1890 to 1930. And again, I meant to say, if you get tired of facts and figures, you will be tired of this real shortly. But there was a lot going on that 40-year span. A lot was going on in America. So just to get us thinking, in 1890, only about 28% of the population lived in cities, leaving the majority of the population living on farms in the rural setting. And that was 1890, but by 1920, just 30 years later, it was about 50-50. So it changed quite a bit. Quite a bit more moved into cities, and as many lived in cities and in farms by 1920. Now, so where is that today? This is a Google search, but today, it's estimated that around 80% of the population lives in urban areas or in the cities, with only 20% of America's population living in rural settings. Also around the same time, because of medications and general improvements in cleanliness and hygiene, the life expectancy of Americans grew, I guess that's the right way to say it, grew by 10 years between 1900 and 1930. I don't know what the ages were, but if people were dying around 50, they began to live to 60 or whatever it was, 55 to 65, I'm not sure. So that was another change that happened. The other thing that was going on was a Great Depression in 1929. It was another tumultuous thing going on in this country and around the world for that matter. And so numerous programs to help with financial assistance were started by high-ranking people in all part. And this, again, is on the website, all kinds of different names and programs that were attempted to be started, and some gained some traction, and some looked pretty attractive and seemed to be working, because the unemployment rate was up to 25%+ of people were unemployed after the Great Depression, at the beginning of the Great Depression. And the heyday of America took 25 years, I think it said, to recover from the stock market crash. So some of these programs worked and some didn't. Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt, President Roosevelt at the time, he and his wife received many letters from needy people requesting assistance, financial help. By 1934, there were many states that had some type of pension program because of how poorly things had gone. There were many states that had some type of pension program in place. However, they were seriously lacking. It says that only about 3% of the elderly in those states were receiving adequate support. So even though many states, I think it said 30-some states, which there wasn't 50 states then yet in America in 34, but 30-some states had programs, but in those states, only about 3% of the people actually received adequate support. And it's estimated that at that time, approximately half of the elderly lacked sufficient income to be self-supportive. So they were living off of somebody. There was some, I think it said there was up to 2 million. That wasn't elderly. There were 2 million, estimate 2 million hobos, grown men that were walking around homeless and jobless during this time of the early 30s. Also around this time, there were around 34 other nations in the world that had some type of insurance program in place, social insurance program in place. So this was not a brand new thought to America. There was other countries that were doing this. After the Social Security was signed into law by President Roosevelt, deductions began in 1937, with benefits not beginning until 1940. So even though this social insurance began or was signed law in 35, it only began to work the way it was supposed to around 1940. Now there was some payouts in 38 and 39, some lump sum payouts, but it did not begin until 1940. And it gave the example of one lady that, because of when she was employed, the way it was set up at that time, had only several paychecks where deductions happened before she retired. think she had paid in around $35, something like that. And then she went on to live to be 100 years old. And so she collected somewhere over $22,000 from that $35 that she paid in, because she lived to be so old. It's also of note that there were skeptical people at the time as well that did not want to take part on being on any type of welfare, and they resisted this program and did not want to become part of it. So the program went through numerous updates and revisions over the years since then, and I'm going to try to explain it the best I can as how the program works today, how it functions today. And again, some of you are well aware of how this works, and some of you maybe are not. So deductions are made from an employee's gross pay. If you get a pay stub, you see the gross pay, the top number, then you see the deductions. There's federal income tax deduction, there's state, there's local, there's Social Security, there's unemployment, there's Medicare. There's probably all line items on some of your paychecks. Social Security takes 6.2% of your gross pay and 1.45% for Medicare. So there's a total of 7.65% deductions off the gross pay of someone who is not Social Security exempt. And then the employer pays the same amount of your gross pay. The employer pays 7.65% as well in a Social Security fund. So that leaves 15.3% of your gross pay goes into the Social Security Administration. So for a self-employed individual, they need to pay 15.3% between Social Security and Medicare taxes. And that's deducted from the net income, which is the money that's left over after the business expenses are paid. There is, just in case you don't know this, Social Security at this point is capped. If your earnings are more than $176,100 annually, you will not pay taxes over your annual income if it's over $176,000. That probably does not include many, if anybody, here. You will not be taxed on those earnings if they're over that. So a person generally needs 40 credits before they can collect Social Security. And the maximum amount of credits that someone can earn is 4 per year. So you can only begin collecting after you have paid in 10 years. Now there are, and I'm not going to go into the details on that, there are a few ways that people can collect before they get their 40 credits in, and that's via disability and all that. But again, they need to have paid in, I think, a number of consecutive credits in order to get this. So you don't need to have 40 consecutive credits. You can get those 40 credits over 20 years, but it's all based on the amount of income that you have in a quarter as to whether or not you earn a credit. So it takes at least 10 years for someone to begin to be able to retrieve benefits. And at retirement, Medicare benefits begin for the individual that is collecting Social Security, and that is to cover medical costs. And there's different levels of that, and we're not going to get into that. Some more facts about this. In 1940, there was approximately 222,000 Americans that were beginning to collect, that started collecting Social Security benefits. About 222,000. The most recent information, and this is right on the administration's website, in May of 2025, there's approximately 74 million people receiving benefits. Of those 74 million, 57 million are retired people. People that have taken retirement, whether they took retirement at 62 or 65 or 67, but they are retired status collecting Social Security benefits. So today, as of May 2025, there's around $130 billion monthly paid out in benefits by the Social Security Administration. So it averages out to approximately $1,800 per person. Now, it's not all the same, but that's how it averages out. So it's a staggering number of $130 billion per month. So I think right away is the question is, what happens, how many people are paying in? So we have 74 million receiving benefits. How many are paying in? So there's around 183 million Americans paying into Social Security. As of 2023, that's the most recent information I could find. With a median income in the states, I know these are all general numbers, of $62,000 annual income, it works out to there's approximately $400 paid in per person per month. Of the 183 million Americans, is approximately $400 per month per person. Which, if you calculate it out, that's about a 4-to-1 ratio. We need the money from four people paying in. America needs money from four people paying in to divvy out to every one person that is collecting to meet the monthly financial needs. So in a 4-to-1, in order for that math to work out long term, instead of 183 million paying in, America would need to be closer to, and I didn't even calculate this out, but almost 300 million. We need to be paying in for it to be balancing out. So there's not as much money coming in as what's going out. So how do your finances work out if that's happening? Do your finances work out if the money's going out faster than it's coming in? Of course not. It doesn't take any mathematician to figure that out. So the system was expected to be broke in 2035. And that, I know I've said that before several years ago. I think I touched on that in a message. The system was expected to be broke in 2035. And the most recent information is that date has been changed to a year earlier. They expect the Social Security system to be broke by 2034. And so the short-term remedy is, at that time, what's proposed at this point is to cut benefits, everyone's benefits, by 80% rather than their full benefits, they'll only be receiving 80%. And I know that may have been a lot of numbers and stumbling over words. And there's much more that I'm not going to go into. That is the Social Security system as I understand it, as I was able to understand it today. Now, what about the exemption? We know that the church and the state do not operate on the same principles, which is why the state believed would be a good solution to help the needy ended up requiring people to violate their conscience. And this is not a new problem. Daniel had the same problem. He was not allowed to pray because the government said he wasn't allowed to pray, but he did anyhow. The three Hebrews and all the people in Babylon were told, you got to bow down to the king only, bow down to this idol. They said, no, we can't. We're going to remain standing. So this is not a new problem for those that's violating their conscience. The exemption process was started by the Amish in 1955. And because I might forget to say it later, we also have the Amish to thank for our Christian day school privileges that we have today. They began that work. In 1955, when the government required that self-employed farmers and others that were self-employed are required to pay Social Security, that is when the Amish started a 10-year process of meetings, petitions, fines. There's lots of stories out there of what all happened during those 10 years. The state also attempted revisions that they thought would pacify the Amish in their quest to be exempt, but they did not work because they were not operating according to the conscience that the Amish were coming. So there are a number of stories about how IRS agents tried to get money from people. And one of the more notable ones I'm going to relate was Mr. Byler, was a traditional Amish in New Wilmington, Pennsylvania, which is just on the north side of Pittsburgh, about the Ohio line, had refused to pay Social Security tax, and he was a farmer. And they had come to him more than once requesting that he pay up, and he was refusing to pay. For conscience sake, he was not paying his bill. One April morning in 1961, he had hitched up his team of horses and began to plow his field. Three IRS agents strode across the field where he was plowing and stopped his team, demanding that he pay up. And he said, I will not pay up. The IRS agents proceeded to unhitch the horses and walk them off the farm and confiscated his horses to pay his Social Security past due taxes. Sometime later, they sold these horses on public auction to pay his past due taxes, and they also used money from that to pay the cost of the transport and what it cost to care for the horses until they were sold. His taxes got paid, and they sent him the remaining balance from the sale of the horses amounting to $37.89, not to mention he was without horses. The public outcry was pretty loud, with people accusing the government of taking away the ability of an honest person to earn a living. And it made national news. And the news even reached communist countries that accused the United States of being hypocritical in declaring that they are a free country by acting like this. And so the pressure mounted from that situation. And I'm sorry to say that the Amish did file a suit, which they later withdrew. They did file a suit against the state, but they later withdrew it. So exemption was eventually granted in 1965. And later, the next year, the IRS approved the Form 4029. However, this exemption was only for the self-employed. The exemption was not expanded to include employees who worked for exempt employers until 1988. Only 1988 was there exemption granted for employees of exempt employers. And I know that may be a little tough to explain, but it's still that way today. If you are employed for an employer who is not an exempt employer, you are required and forced to pay Social Security tax, whether or not you're exempt. You may be exempt while you're working there, exempt with the government, but you will still need to pay in Social Security tax. And many, I should have said, during this time of gaining an exemption for employees of exempt employers, there was more than just the Amish that were part of this. There was many, a number of Eastern men and other Mennonites that were working together, had written letters, had meetings with the government. And one thing the author of this book wrote that he was impressed with in the school situation and in the Social Security thing is the Amish were not bashful to arrange a meeting with high-ranking authorities. They were not embarrassed or bashful to go and actually meet with them. And they met with them respectfully, but they were not afraid of that, and they were willing and happy to do that. So how does exemption function today? If you are employed by a non-exempt employer or an employer that pays in their taxes, their Social Security taxes, you will be required to have Social Security taxes deducted from your paycheck. You may be exempt personally, but the taxes will need to be withheld. You will not be able to collect benefits even though you've paid in to the program. And I know this firsthand because after my father-in-law fell, I was asked to go and check with the Social Security Administration there in Lebanon. I had a meeting with in their office because my father-in-law was exempt from his teen years, but for many of the years that he had worked, he had paid in Social Security for, I think it was 34 years, he had paid it in. But he was exempt. And so I met with them to see if there was any reversal of that. And there is no way to reverse that. I should say there is no way. There is a way to reverse that. You can reverse that, but you will start over, need to work your 10 years to get your 40 credits. And what you paid in up to that point is in the system and will never be yours. An exempt employer can employ non-exempt employees. They will just need to deduct that 7.65% from the employee and will also need to pay the other 7.65% that is required. Any money that's paid in, oh, I already said that. Also, you must also know that an exemption request will be denied if a person has received benefits in the past. An example, let's say someone collects disability, they hurt themselves, they're 29 years old, hurt themselves, they paid in, they got their credits, and they're getting disability because they hurt themselves and they're gaining disability for a year. And then along around 35 years old, they join the Mennonites or the Amish and become part of the church and have the conviction of being exempt. And they want to become exempt. They will not be allowed to be exempt unless they pay back the benefits that they received. And there's also another situation I know of where a lady was a toddler when her dad passed away and had been paying Social Security. And so she received benefits till she was 18 years old. And when she wanted to go exempt in her later teens, and when she was 19, she was denied because she received benefits from the time she was 18 months old until she was 18 years old. So the only option was for her to pay it back. And she opted not to do that because she was not going to work. She was not going to work any amount as a married woman and a mother. So what is the 4029? 4029 can only be used by persons who are part of an exempt church group. And a church group can only be exempted if they can be traced to a group who has continually held the conviction of Social Security exemption since December 31 of 1950. I'm not sure they arrived at that number, but that is right on the form if you look at it. Only have a conviction about receiving government and insurance support and benefits since 1950. Each congregation needs to have applied and been approved with Form 1458 before members can apply. And I need to do that. Like I announced the other month, we did get our congregation approved because of the conference change. It's required that you fill out another 4029 anytime that you change a church group. Now, if you would change from attending Tyrone and go to Winchester, you're not changing a church group. You're still part of the same conference. But if you were to leave our church and move to the West Coast and become part of Western Fellowship, the IRS expects you to fill out another 4029. And that was something we learned more recently. It was made clear to us with this application for our congregation, because there's many of you that probably have old forms, at least a number of you that have old forms that date back to a conference that you left years ago. So what I mean by part of an exempt church group, if someone here was decided that you're going to go and begin a new church group this week without documentation that's approving this church group to start, you will not be able to receive a 1458. We had to submit, Brother Stewart worked with our conference, he had to submit documentation from various meetings and minutes that showed that we went back to Pilgrim, and then the Social Security Administration already has it. Pilgrim was part of Eastern, which would have been back in the 60s, and then back beyond that, Langston Conference. And so the paper trail can be traced that Daystar Mennonite Conference has been continuously part of an exempt church group since 1950. And so if someone starts a random church group without the authorization or the approval of another group, they will have difficulty and maybe will not be able to get a form, get 1458 approval, which will also not allow anyone to get 4029 exemption approval. Additionally, an offshoot that chooses to leave teachings of their former group will probably have difficulty getting approval. So even if a group is authorized to start an offshoot, if they leave their former beliefs and convictions in certain areas, they may not be able to get approvals. So just, I hope I'm not repeating myself, but when I submit the 1458 for our congregation, I need to include documentation, and also of high importance were documents stating what our position is in assisting widows and needy within the congregation. You need to have a stated position in order to do that, and I had to submit that with ours so that they know that if there's a need here, it is helped with the alms fund in some way from the congregation. Also of note, The Social Security Administration uses Mennonite and Amish church directories as their congregational and district database. And it verifies that our congregation is part of Daystar Conference. And they do, yes, they do have the Christian Light Directory, and they get a new one every year, the Social Security Administration, to verify that church groups are legit. It is, as Brother Stewart said, Bill told him from the Social Security office that the Christian Light Directory is their Bible to know if a church group is legitimate. And then the Amish and other conferences have their own directory stating that. So they do use it. This is also an arm of the government that is quite active, and they are paying attention to details. When I submitted our congregation's 1458, I got turned down 2 times over what seemed like small details that I missed in the application process. They do pay attention to this, and they follow it, and they keep track of it. Nothing is assumed, and the paperwork needs to be clear. Today, more so than even 10 years ago, there's many accountants requiring physical copies of the 4029s to be in their files as well when you receive an exemption. If you are 4029 exempt, or if you wish to be, you need to fill out the form in the next few months so that you may stay compliant. And I would recommend that you do that before the end of the year, so that you have your approval back and copies can be with your accountant and also in your possession. Because of our conference change, and I don't mean this to plant fear, but because of our conference change, we've gotten the attention of the Social Security Administration, so I think we should be especially diligent with getting paperwork filled out and updated. Another thing about the exemption, it is imperative that you inform the administration within 60 days if you leave an exempt church and no longer hold membership. It's considered a violation to the law if you were exempt and leave an exempt congregation. Another thing is, we are in the third generation. That's what Brother Kurtz said in his topic. And I don't know what you know about third generation things, but third generation things, it's not a rule, but pretty often, even in businesses, third generations tend to squander things. And his burden was that we are in the third generation. And do we understand what men of the past fought for, what it was all about? And that is what the next message is going to be more about. What drove them to fight for it? Should it be, is it still the same? Should we be fighting the same way? So, is this an option? Should we view this as a take it or leave it? Or should you view it as a way to receive nearly 8% more income today of your paycheck? Is this a privilege? The government gives us this privilege. It is a privilege of some. Is this exemption a devoir? Meaning, is this a method by which we can and should honor the kingdom? I hope you all can find time to take in part 2, not because I will be preaching it, but because it may help balance out the lack of balance in this morning's message. But Lord willing, within the next few weeks, we will go on to part 2 and talk about more of those questions. Thank you all for your attentiveness. May God bless you. Let's kneel together for prayer.